Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we go over recent developments in the public safety workplace. But first, I've got to tell you that we've actually won some sort of award for this podcast. I didn't know anybody was even giving awards, but the LRIS First Thursday podcast was recently recognized by FeedSpot as one of the top 10 employment law podcasts. FeedSpot's a company that assists marketers in tracking down bloggers and podcasters so that they can place ads. We're not going to place ads, but that's what FeedSpot does. And it ranks podcasts on the basis of their reputation on Google and popularity on social media sites, quality, how they assess quality is another question, consistency of episodes, and editorial team review. And we ended up, get this, we ended up in fourth place. Fourth place? That's when I heard that. That sort of reminded me of that very ironic provision in William Shakespeare's will that left to his wife, Anne Hathaway, and I'm quoting now, his second best bed. That's kind of like what winning fourth place is like. Why aren't we number one? I think it's because all of you need to go to iTunes and give us positive reviews. I'm probably not supposed to be saying that, but then again, Apple just announced that iTunes is being ended, and they're going to change into iTunes into not one but three different applications, one of which will still be podcast. Incidentally, the Ogletree Deacons podcast, that's a management side firm, was also recognized. We interviewed two of their attorneys for our premium podcast talking about the FMLA, and the Ogletree Deacons podcast is really a good one. Keeping up to date on national, more employment than labor law issues. So at any rate, it's nice to be recognized. Even if we're fourth best, it's nice to be recognized. Now I want to get very, very, very serious with you. And it's about something that happened within the last 24 hours of when I'm recording this podcast. I'm recording it on Tuesday, the first Tuesday in June. There was a release of information and a website by something known as the Plainview Project. What's the Plainview Project? It's a database of Facebook posts and other social media posts made by current and former police officers from several jurisdictions across the United States. Who are these people and what are they doing? And the answer as to who they are is on the website, and we will link to the Plainview Project on our website. And what they say is that they are comprised of a team of attorneys who in 2016 learned that numerous local police officers in Philadelphia, that's where the lawyers are, had posted content on Facebook, and I'm quoting now, that appeared to endorse violence, racism, and bigotry. The About section of the Plainview website says that in some of these posts, officers commented that apprehended suspects, often black men, should be dead or should have more lumps on their head. And they advocated shooting looters on sight and using cars to run over protesters. I probably don't need to tell you what they culled out in terms of posts on Islam and Muslims and women. I mean, it's kind of the worst of the worst posts that you can imagine on Facebook. And so what this team of lawyers did was to create what they're calling this Plainview Project, and they identified, they don't say how, but they identified eight different jurisdictions from around the country where they were going to go try and find the off-duty social media posts of police officers. What are those jurisdictions? Philadelphia, Dallas, St. Louis, Phoenix, York, that's a city in Pennsylvania, Twin Falls, Idaho, Denison, Texas, and Lake County, Florida. Now, that's a disparate set of jurisdictions, and it's not at all clear how they picked any of those jurisdictions. But nonetheless, that's what they did. They picked them. So what then did they do with that information? What they did was to make Public Records Act requests and try to identify a roster of police officers in each of those jurisdictions. What they wanted to do was to confirm that people who were making posts as police officers were actually police officers. And they compiled a list of what they've now describe as a verified Facebook profiles of police officers in each of the jurisdictions. They reviewed the public posts and comments made by 3,500 of those officers, and the results are online. And it's the results are in a database that you can find on the Plainview website. And it includes more than 5,000 separate posts. And if you look through the posts, I can guarantee you, you're going to be dismayed by what you see in the posts. Not only you will be dismayed, the employers are dismayed. Because right now, there are internal affairs investigations that have been launched across the country in these various jurisdictions based on what was released in the last 24 hours. There are hundreds of police officers who are under investigation today who were not yesterday, and it's all for their social media posts. So I wanted to use this chain of events to probably preach to the choir that is amongst you. Public safety employees, and it's not just police officers, okay? Because I've seen this from firefighters as well. There's a subset of public safety employees who think, A, they can post anything they want on social media and it's going to be constitutionally protected, and B, that nobody is looking over their shoulder when they are making those posts. Both of those propositions are dead wrong. There is no special First Amendment constitutional protection for saying something on social media. If it's not protected, if you stand outside the chief's office and shout it to the world, it's not protected if you post it on social media. Public safety employees and the unions that represent them and the employers that employ them have to make it absolutely clear to employees, stop. Stop with the aggressive posts on social media. If you want to post about what you've eaten for dinner, if you want to post about your latest vacation, or, you know, hopefully you want to post the latest cat or dog or llama meme or whatever it might be, fine. But don't be posting about your views on Islam and its status as a religion. What was released by the Plainview Project, if, in fact, officers posted what you see in that database, the release of that information is going to cost some officers their jobs. And officers, public safety employees, need to understand that to the extent that the days were ever there that you could say stuff on social media and get a free pass, those days are gone. And if you ever needed any assurance on the second point being there's no one watching, just go to the Plainview Project's webpage. There's someone watching. This is just one law firm in one city, and they've given the rest of the country a good idea about what to do to track the social media posts of public safety employees. They lay it all out. It's right there in the webpage. You can go to a webpage or subpage that talks about what they call metadata sourcing, and they lay it out for you as to how you can find the social media posts of public safety employees. Why are they doing this? Doesn't matter, really, as to why it is they're doing it. I'll give you their explanation. I don't buy it, but I'll give you their explanation. I'm quoting, "We present these posts and comments because we believe that they could undermine public trust and confidence in our police. In our view, people who are subject to decisions made by law enforcement may fairly question whether these online statements about race, religion, ethnicity, and the acceptability of violent policing, among other topics, inform officers' on-the-job behaviors and choices. To be clear, our concern is not whether these posts and comments are protected by the First Amendment." Now, the reason I don't buy that is you could say that about any of a variety of different professions. This is law enforcement, public safety, being singled out for special treatment. It's going to have all sorts of reverberations, right? All sorts of reverberations that I think will resound right down to an exacerbation of the recruitment and retention crisis that we're in this country. We've just all got to realize that social media is not a friendly environment for public safety employees. The way I put it in some of our seminars is this. And this is advice that I give to unions, and I'll tell you the advice I give to employers in a moment. But I say to unions, look, at every general membership meeting that you are holding, those same general membership meetings where the same 17 people show up, at every one, you need to take a minute or two and emphasize the lack of protection for posts on social media. You know, I don't even want to get into the nature of these posts and whether it's right or wrong for officers to have these sorts of feelings, although I think you'll probably be appalled at some of the posts when you see them. I don't want to get into that. I don't want to get into whether or not these are protected by the First Amendment. What I want to do is try to save these officers' jobs before they make these posts. And the way to do that is for unions to be proactive in communicating with their members about these issues, and also for employers at every opportunity in training to make it very clear what the rules are for social media posts. Okay, I know I've ranted a while about this, and I just view it as being a very, very serious issue. You know, if you've listened to these podcasts, one of the things we do at LRIS is we set out all these news trawlers on the internet where we try to pick up articles around the country about public safety employees and their employment lives. And I'll tell you, not a week goes by, some weeks, not a day goes by, that we don't read an article from somewhere, from Kentucky, from Texas, from Arizona, wherever it might be, where a police officer, a firefighter, a corrections officer, a deputy sheriff, a trooper has lost their job because of social media posts. It's time to stop. It's time to get a hold of this problem. Let's turn to Pennsylvania now for a case that comes up with some degree of regularity. What happens if you're sitting down at the bargaining table and there's someone on the other side of the table that you really, really don't like? Maybe there's a history that you've got with that individual where they frustrated bargaining in the past. Maybe it's something to do with their reputation, something you've heard about them, and you know it's not going to be good once they come to your table. Or perhaps it's something about their status. You don't like the position that they hold. Maybe they're an outside negotiator as opposed to an inside negotiator. Maybe they're a lawyer and you haven't had lawyers at your table in the past. Whatever the reason might be, can you refuse to negotiate with that individual present. And that's the issue that Pennsylvania's Labor Relations Board recently faced in a case involving what's known as the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority. Think Philadelphia's transit system when you think about SEPTA. And they have a fairly large police department, and the rank and file members of that police department are represented by Lodge 109 of the Fraternal Order of Transit Police. All right, so setting the table for what happened in this case. The parties here had a pretty long collective bargaining agreement, a four-year agreement. It ran from 2012 to 2016. A year after it expires, the parties enter into a memorandum of agreement that extended the terms of the contract through 2018. So you've got basically a two-year extension of the collective bargaining agreement. As you get towards the middle of this extension period, SEPTA issues three orders that become the focus of this case. The first one pertains to the operation of police vehicles, and this order says as long as an officer is inside a police vehicle, the driver's window and the front passenger window must be at least halfway down. There are some exceptions for inclement weather or driving on a freeway, but other than that, the windows have to be half down. I can tell you, as long as I've been in this business, I have never seen such a rule in a police department's policy manual, but something must have happened, right? There's going to be all of these kind of quirky rules have their origins in individual cases, and something happened in SEPTA where SEPTA decided you got to have your windows half down, except in cases of bad weather or when you're flying somewhere on the freeway. A second policy change that SEPTA wanted to accomplish would have prohibited the use of SEPTA-issue mobile cell phones for personal purposes. That's probably not a bad idea, right? It's not a bad idea from the employer's standpoint for a lot of different reasons. And it's probably not a bad idea, frankly, from the union's standpoint, because the employees don't have an expectation of privacy in an employer-issued cell phone. But nonetheless, the Fraternal Order of Transit Police, I'll just call them Lodge 109, they want to bargain over that order as well. And the third policy change is an order that states that, and I'm quoting here, any officer who is out of the public eye, restroom, district headquarters, locker room, etc., must notify dispatch by radio with their location and reason. You have to tell the employer when and where you're going to use the restroom. Once again, there has to be a story behind this rule, right? I wish we knew the story, but we don't. So you got these three rule changes. And are these rule changes mandatory for bargaining? Well, probably. All three of them are. That's not what this case is important for, though. What's important is that Lodge 109 demands to bargain. And eventually, the parties set up a meeting. And this meeting is held on March 30, 2017. Lodge 109 has four individuals there at the meeting: their president, their vice president, their treasurer, and their lawyer, Thomas Cohn. On the other side of the table, you have the police chief, a fellow named Thomas Nestel, along with several members of the command staff. And they're all sitting around kind of waiting, and then somebody else shows up for SEPTA. His name is Chad Cuneo, and he's the chief labor relations officer for SEPTA. Cuneo says hi to the union representatives and then looks at Cohn and says, "Who's that?" The union president says, "This is Lodge 109's lawyer." Cuneo says, "Nope, not going to meet as long as Cohn, the lawyer, is present." When he's asked for a reason, Cuneo states that this is just an administrative meeting. The president says, Well, no, this is a bargaining meeting. We're bargaining over these policy changes. Cuneo, the labor relations guy, responds that we don't have to bargain over any of that stuff. We're happy to discuss Lodge 109's concerns as long as that lawyer, that guy, is not there. And then the meeting ends. And Lodge 109 files an unfair labor practice complaint. And among other things, the complaint alleges that SEPTA committed an unfair labor practice by refusing to negotiate, refusing even to meet with Lodge 109 if Cohn was present in the room. And Pennsylvania's Labor Relations Board completely agrees with Lodge 109 on this. And I'll read you a couple of sentences from the board's opinion, and then we'll talk a little bit more about why this kind of has to be the rule, right? So here's what the board is saying. I'm quoting, "Bargaining units are free to choose their own bargaining agent and to use a negotiator of their own choosing on their behalf in bargaining sessions. Such a negotiator is an agent of the bargaining unit in that role. An employer must accept and bargain with the representative selected by the union. The fact that the representative may be personally objectionable to the employer or that he is not an employee does not relieve the employer from its duty to bargain." So when I say that that really has to be the rule, why am I saying that? Well, because if one side to bargaining, whether it's the employer, as in this case, or it could be the union objecting to an employer's representative, if one side could say, we're not going to meet if she's there, then what you're doing is you're letting that party control who the other side chooses as negotiators. You can't do that. If you started down that road as a labor board, as the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board, you would be going down that road forever. And the employer or the union could pick and choose who it was on the other side of the table. So this decision from the Labor Relations Board in Pennsylvania comes out the way these cases always come out. And sometimes they even come out this way when there's a pretty rich history that the attorney, usually they're lawyers, sorry about that, that the attorney in the room has behaved badly, a much more of a history than there is that Cohn, in this case, had ever done anything bad. And the labor board still say, you got to bargain with whoever it is the union or the employer chooses. If that person acts up in bargaining, if that person makes good faith bargaining impossible in these negotiations, then we'll consider an unfair labor practice complaint. But you may not prophylactically refuse to negotiate with a particular individual. Let's move now to California, and this is a case that's decided by an administrative law judge for California's Public Employment Relations Board. It involves the city of Santa Maria, which is along the California coast, about roughly midway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's a perfectly lovely case. Lovely, not so much in terms of the outcome, but in terms of the issues it presents and the resolution of them, that deals with three pretty important issues. And the first is there bargaining that's required over changes in a promotional process? In this case, it's the promotional process for the position of fire captain. The second issue is, how far do protections for union speech go? Can an employer clamp down on what might otherwise be protected union speech because it disagrees with the speech or because the speech is having some sort of operational limits? And where are the lines drawn on that particular issue? And then the third issue that is raised in this case is, can an employer act in a discriminatory fashion against individual union members because of their speech, when the only action is that it initiates an investigation, does that action trigger the union's ability to file an unfair labor practice complaint? Even though the results of the investigation might be that every single union member is cleared, no discipline is imposed, is the very action of initiating the investigation enough so that the employer would commit an unfair labor practice? Okay, let's talk about this case and how these issues arise. And they all start in March of 2016. There was an interim fire chief. He's referred to in the opinion as the then interim fire chief, so presumably he's the chief now. His name is Scott Kenley in Santa Maria, and he raises with the union, which is the Santa Maria Firefighters Association, the possibility of running what's referred to as an open recruitment for the position of captain. What does that mean, open recruitment? It means that people who are not employees of the fire department will be allowed to test for and potentially be awarded the job of fire captain. Kenley's worried because there's been low interest in promotion to the position of captain, very few applications. The fire department has never had external applicants compete for mid-level management positions like fire engineer or captain. The union is quite concerned about it. In particular, the president, a fellow named Anthony Morales, discusses the issue with Kenley and says, look, we're opposed to this. We don't want to open up the recruitment process to outsiders. The discussions kind of go back and forth and back and forth, and eventually nothing happens. And the department runs a recruitment for the captain position. It's not open to outside applicants. There's a sufficient number of internal applicants, and promotions are made from the list. However, the following year, 2017, we have a change in chiefs. And this time, the new chief is a fellow named Leonard Champion. Champion doesn't go the same approach that Kenley went. He doesn't bother talking to the union. He simply announces that he is going to implement an open captain's recruitment. And he takes the position that this is a management right. I have the ability to do this. Well, the association is a member of a statewide organization. It's called the California Professional Firefighters, and the association reports all this to CPF, as it's called. And CPF issues something that is called a do not apply alert. What is this? This is a document that is circulated statewide among all of CPF's member organizations. And it says, we are asking, and I'm quoting, for your help and support by not applying for the captain's post in Santa Maria, and further ask that you help get the word out to our affiliated brothers and sisters and post this on union bulletin boards. Champion gets very upset about this, and he announces that he is going to start an investigation that is going to be done by an independent third-party investigator. And the purpose of the investigation, Champion announced, is to look for culpability among board members of the association in discouraging external applicants from applying for employment. A memorandum that Champion issues says, and I'm quoting, this is going to become important in this opinion, the subject matter during this interview may lead to discipline against you. Failure to attend the meeting will be considered an act of insubordination and can be an independent basis for disciplinary action up to and including dismissal. Okay, let's pause for just a moment here. Don't you think really that people needed to take a deep breath and maybe not look at this point as to what their legal rights and remedies would be, as much as simply trying to solve the problem, trying to figure out if you have enough internal applicants where this time, like last time, you could encourage enough interest in the job to get promotions. And maybe we don't have to be at the point where we're issuing memoranda that say this could result in discipline up to and including termination. Well, cooler heads didn't prevail in Santa Maria, and the association ends up filing an unfair labor practice complaint. And the unfair labor practice complaint says basically three things. It says, first of all, you have to negotiate over this change in past practice, the open recruitment. Secondly, you illegally retaliated against members of the board by initiating the investigation. And the third thing is that illegal retaliation violates California's collective bargaining laws because this is protected union speech. So what does the ALJ do with all of these things? The bargaining issue is pretty easy for the ALJ to resolve. The ALJ says, look, the decision here to run an open promotional recruitment, that's a non-negotiable topic under California law. However, California, like pretty much every place, says simply if a decision is non-negotiable doesn't mean there's no obligation to negotiate, because you may have to negotiate over the effects. And the ALJ says, yes, indeed, because the breadth of the promotional recruitment process has an impact on existing people under the rank of captain in the bargaining unit, there are negotiable effects here. And what does that mean? It means that the union is entitled to advance notice of both the decision and the implementation date so that there's time for meaningful negotiations before the decision is put into effect. The ALJ says city violated all of that here. The city just simply announced that it was going to implement, didn't give the association proper notice or an opportunity to bargain over effects. So, bingo, unfair labor practice number one. Now the ALJ turns to the retaliation charge. And really, what the union has to prove here is, first of all, that the speech is protected. And the ALJ says speech is indeed protected in this case. And a couple of quotes here, I think, that show the breadth of the protections given to union speech. A couple of sentences. The ALJ says, look, the general rule regarding employee speech and conduct is that they're protected under the collective bargaining statutes when they're related to matters of legitimate concern to employees, so as the concerns come under the heading of the ability to participate in an employee organization for purposes of representation on labor relations issues. Now, here's the key sentence. Disputes over wages, hours, or other working conditions are among those most likely to cause ill feelings and strong responses. Thus, the parties are afforded wide latitude to engage in uninhibited, robust, and wide open debate during those disputes. So, in other words, speech protected, that as union speech, it's not always going to be nice speech. It can be robust. There are other cases out there saying, yeah, it can even be profane. It can even be personal. And as long as it is related to the collective bargaining process and something that's mandatory for bargaining, it's going to be protected. So the ALJ finds this speech to be protected. Now, what about the retaliation issue? The employer says, we didn't retaliate against them. Yeah, we did the investigation. We called them in and they were questioned. But in the end, we didn't sustain any charges, and therefore there can't possibly be any retaliation that violates the law. The ALJ's having none of that. The ALJ says, and I'm quoting, "The initiation of an investigation into alleged employee misconduct by the employer may be considered an adverse action against the investigated employee, regardless of whether disciplinary action actually results. In this case, this was a formal investigation. It was serious. It was assigned to an outside investigator. Employees were compelled to attend an interview. The interview was recorded. They were compelled to answer questions under threat of insubordination, and they were advised in writing that their responses could lead to potential termination. The process took several months, and over those several months, as the ALJ puts it, a cloud of suspicion hung over the heads of the executive board members." Bottom line, the ALJ says the city violated the law simply by initiating the investigation. I don't think any of these three conclusions are particularly revolutionary. There's a thread in California case law that promotional standards, like at least standards in the sense of are you going to be having an open recruitment or not, there's a thread in California case law saying that the decision in those areas is a management right. There's also a lot of case law saying you got to negotiate the effects of the exercise of that management right. And there's certainly plenty of case law all over the country saying that wide open, robust union speech is protected, and you can't even investigate it without, if you are the employer, interfering with the union's right to represent employees. All right, let's head on down to New Orleans for a Bill of Rights case. Actually, I wouldn't mind heading down to New Orleans on this rainy Portland afternoon. This is an issue. What happens in this case is an issue that comes up all the time in states with statutory bills of rights. And there are 17 of them, by my count, that have bills of rights for law enforcement, about four that have bills of rights for firefighters. And if you have a bill of rights that has time frames, statutes of limitation, within which a disciplinary investigation must be conducted, then you get cases from time to time as to what happens when the employer blows the statute of limitations. What happens when the investigation is not conducted within the specified time period? There's a Bill of Rights under Louisiana law for police, and it specifies that there is a 60-day limitation on disciplinary investigations. There's an exception if the investigation is into alleged criminal activity, but generally speaking, it's a 60-day statute of limitations, and it is very strictly written. Let me read you the sentence, there's two sentences in the statute that shows you how strictly the legislature wanted these provisions interpreted. Quoting, "There shall be no discipline, demotion, or adverse action of any sort taken against a police officer unless the investigation is conducted in accordance with the minimum standards provided for in this law. Any discipline, demotion, or adverse action of any sort whatsoever taken against a police officer, wait for it, without complete compliance with the foregoing minimum standards is an absolute nullity." Wow, an absolute nullity. All right, that's our backdrop. What are the facts in this case? It involves Kevin Pozo. Kevin Pozo is a police officer with the New Orleans Police Department. In December 2015, Pozo and his then-fiancée, Melanie Wilson, They shared a residence. They were drinking at home. And then they decided, okay, let's go over to a friend's open house party. And they continue to drink there. Wilson starts talking to other men at the party. Pozo becomes upset. Pozo confronts one of the men. And Pozo and Wilson are then asked to leave the party. At about 7 p.m., I wonder when these parties started, they returned home, and a dispute happens. In the middle of the dispute, Pozo admittedly threw a glass beer bottle against an interior wall, causing the bottle to shatter. What happened next is in dispute, and this is Pozo admitted a little bit, but not everything. And as someone once used the phrase for me, it may be that he confessed the misdemeanor and denied the felony. Who knows? So what the department ends up concluding is that Pozo committed a domestic abuse battery on Wilson. He pushed a chair that she was seated in. It caused her to fall to the floor. The department's investigators also allege that Pozo aggressively forced the front door against Wilson, preventing her from leaving the home, and that, in other words, it was basically false imprisonment as well. Pozo has a different recollection of events. He testified that he kind of shook the chair that Wilson was sitting in, but she didn't fall off it, and that when she tried to leave through the front door, he stopped her, but only because she was heavily intoxicated and he did not want her to drive. Pozo has a different story, and later on, in the middle of her account, she testifies that she basically doesn't remember too much of what happened that night, so I'm not going to even bother with what her different story was. Pozo's criminally charged, and in 2016, June 24th, 2016, that's going to become important, a judge returns a verdict of not guilty. That same day, June 24th, the department begins its administrative investigation. It completes the investigation within 60 days. But after the expiration of the 60 days, the investigator supplemented her report by adding a transcript of testimony from the criminal trial. The department fires Pozo, and he files a lawsuit, and his argument, his basic argument on appeal is, you violated the 60-day rule by supplementing the administrative investigation after the 60 days had expired. And the Louisiana Court of Appeals agrees. The court says, look, if we allow the department to add exhibits to its investigation, add substance to its investigation following the expiration of 60 days, that would essentially render the 60-day deadline moot. And here's the court's tagline on the case. One of the minimum standards in the Bill of Rights is that each investigation shall be completed within 60 days. Here, there has been no strict compliance with the Bill of Rights. We therefore find that the termination of Pozo is rendered an absolute nullity. You hear the court echoing the words of the Bill of Rights, the words of the statute there, right? That there has been no strict compliance, that's in the statute, and therefore we have an absolute nullity. That's in the statute as well. These results are very predictable in states that have these sorts of statutory bills of rights. There's probably two dozen of these cases from California Court of Appeals alone on employers that have not completed the investigation. In California, it's not 60 days, it's a year, have not completed the investigation within a year. If you're in a state that has a Bill of Rights with one of these time limits, you just simply have to build a calendar and tickler and reminder system, if you're the employer, where the investigation is done within that time period. no excuses, no explanations are going to matter to a court. If you don't get it done in 60 days or a year or whatever the time limit is, you can expect that the disciplinary proceedings against the employee will be dismissed. I want to close by thanking all of you who wrote in about the suggestion I threw out there last month that we might want to hold a wellness seminar for public safety employees, talk about psychological and physiological health. The response was overwhelming, and it was very, very positive. And based upon that response, we're going to do something. We're going to try to craft a seminar for some time in 2020, and we're going to try to bring in leading experts from around the country to talk about the importance of wellness and the benefits of wellness, not just for public safety employees themselves, but also their employers. Stay tuned. We'll get you more details on that. Next seminar that we've got coming up is in September, and that's our seminar on grievances and arbitration. This is very, very well-liked seminar. We've got a great slate of speakers. If you're interested in the seminar, come to our webpage at LRIS.com. And with that, thank you for listening. This has been the June 2019 edition of First Thursday, and this is Will Aitchison signing off.